a dozen years old, and it has been going slowly, partly because I wanted to take a break in the last decade to try to understand non-renormalizable theories in general. To introduce you to that, I give you some basic background. Here we have, on this slide, we have two model classical actions. We have A plus and minus, and that reflects the plus and minus in the power here. So we have a harmonic oscillator plus an anharmonic term with either a plus 4 or a minus 4. The plus 4 has all the natural properties. If you take the limit as g goes to 0, that action goes to the free action with these kind of solutions for arbitrary b and arbitrary beta. On the other hand, if you take the minus 4 here, then any path that would enter this action as a functional that crosses x equals 0 and it makes this integral finite makes this integral then infinite. So such paths are forbidden now from the action functional. And so the limit of this minus 4 story as g goes to 0 is not the free action. It's what I call a pseudo-free action here. Pseudo-free action, and here are the solutions of that particular problem, similar to these solutions, but they stay either on the positive axis or on the negative side. Sorry, the positive side or the negative side. Quantum mechanically, the limitation as g goes to 0 is also different. Here is the propagator for the plus 4 story in the limit that g goes to 0, which gives the free propagator, which you know well. These are the Hermite functions. But if I take the minus 4 story, solve that with a finite g, and then take the limit as g goes to 0, I do not get the free propagator, I get this propagator. And this theta function, which is 1 for positive argument, 0 for negative argument, has the same feature. Only you can only connect a plus with a plus or a minus with a minus starting point. Pictorially, if this is the theory space, then the plus 4 story, if I have it interacting, I turn it off, I go back to the free theory. That's what we saw right here. But for the minus story, if I turn off the interaction, I don't go back to the free theory, I go to the pseudo-free theory, which has this kind of behavior classically and this kind of behavior quantum mechanically. So this picture works both for the classical and the quantum story. And my picture number 1 on the board is to remind you that we are going to be talking about theories of that kind. Sir. Question.
I don't understand why you have absolute value in the classical theory.
Because this is minus 4. So if you have a path that wants to go through.
The center is divergent.
It's divergent.
Okay.
So here's the outline. These are post-it notes for my help on the side. We're going to start with a scalar field story and understand how that can be made. This starts out non-renormalizable, but how that can be solved and made finite with a key idea called measure mashing. We're going to review affine quantum gravity. It's a non-canonical story. It's 3 plus 1, but it's not canonical. And to my surprise, the measure mashing, which was the secret for salvation and making finite the scalar fields, already appears in the affine quantum gravity story. People fuss a lot about finding inner products for their functional Hilbert space and the measure, etc. We're going to talk about the reproducing kernel Hilbert space as a very helpful idea for Hilbert space representations. We're going to turn attention then to the diffeomorphism constraints and some toy examples which fulfill that. Have the functional integral formulation of the affine quantum story involving a continuous time regularization. And that functional integral is, in fact, remarkably well defined. And then we'll talk about the enforcing all the constraints, and summary will be question time. It's kind of a implication to minimize the questions in the middle. Okay, let's start with number one, scalar fields and measure meshing. I'm going to take a very simplified scalar field. There's no spatial gradients, just has a time derivative, but it does have spatial extent in the, let's say, 3 plus 1 story here, written here. Now, if I set G0 equal to 0, that's the free action, clear enough, and it only puts an imposition on the function phi that it has to be square integrable. But for every value of the positive coupling constant G0, not only must it be square integrable, it must be fourth power integral. Now, there are plenty of functions which are square integrable, which are not fourth power integrable, but they have to be that for all G0 as G0 tends to 0. That means the interacting theory taken to 0 with the coupling constant does not equal the same action as the original free theory. So that has a pseudo-free content to it, and we shouldn't be surprised if we find that the free theory is not in our story at all. Okay, here's the Euclidean action, straightforward. I'm going to put it on a lattice space-time. K is not a Fourier transform variable, it's a multi-integer labeling the lattice sites. K0 will be the Euclidean time. Then there's three integers here telling us the other lattice sites. Here's the lattice action. Put that into a path integral and expand this interaction term down here. So we have our free rest, we have our free term and our derivative term plus a source term. And then we imagine calculating those kind of things and eventually going to the continuum limit. Well, that's pretty hard. So let's kind of see if we can learn something about such integrals in general. So this is a space-time average. Let's set the h is equal to 0 for the moment. This is a space-time average over here of some potential v, which this is an illustration for. Now, this summation over k then is a summation over space, I beg your pardon, space and the temporal values. And I'm going to bring out the temporal values, leaving the space values behind. And then I use a simple Hölder inequality, which takes this into separate averages of quantities at equal time. So everybody, here it is. Everybody inside this particular bracket is at the same time. Here is over here at the same time. Up here, they were all at different times within one average. That means now, if I have everything at the same time, then the average in question comes to be slightly different. It becomes with a ground state distribution, averaging for the quantity of interest.
John,
question.
I'm finding this very clear. To go back to the path integral.
I should go back?
To the path integral.
To the previous slide?
No. In this slide, which is the path integral.
Yes.
What is P and why is that potential, why is that interacting term downstairs and not up in the exponential?
Well, there's a summation here.
It was quick. Okay.
I've just made my perturbation series already for you.
Okay.
And now I'm trying to evaluate what kind of thing like that might be. And I found that I can bound this space-time average by simple spatial averages. And so we're going to look at questions of this kind, spatial averages, and learn that they will dominate. So here it is. Space implies space-time averaging.
What's the physics behind dominating space-time average by space-time?
Okay, I have trouble hearing and the noise.
What's the physics? What's the physics behind the next step of separating out the space and averaging in space before you average in time?
So how do you do it? It's not clear how you go from a space-time to a space.
This is just a... there are
What is V?
V is some potential, such as this. It would take too much room to write all these terms every time. V is a shorter form.
Okay, so to start from the left, V times A to the fourth summed over the space-time, K summed over the space-time lattice?
This is the temporal part coming out. leaving only
John, I'm very slow. I don't know about anybody else. One symbol at a time.
Yeah.
The V times A to the fourth summed over the space-time lattice to the P power, expectation value, absolute value.
Yes.
Okay. Now what have you done?
I've already just brought out the spatial, beg your pardon, the temporal sums and left the spatial sum behind. That means the sum over the K1, 2, 3 is here, and the sum over the K0 is outside. And what's left inside?
So what happened to the power of P?
One term, two terms, P terms. And then I use...
Why are you about to take the space, the time average outside the expectation, but the absolute value of it?
Why do I take the time out?
Why are you allowed to take the summation outside the expectation value and the absolute value?
Because this is linear in each of these sums. There's a sum for K01, a sum for K02, sum for K0P, each of the different terms of the P product.
It's an inequality.
That's balanced.
So you have a bunch of terms that could have different signs. So, but if you put absolute value in the sign, then that means you put an upper limit.
Okay. I'm sure I'm the only dumb one here. But
it's okay. And then I've got P terms here, and that in some distribution is equivalent, or is rather is bounded by, the pth power of one of those terms, and then take the 1 by pth of that all the way through. That is a simple Hölder inequality.
Okay.
But at this point, I've got the average here, where everything is at the same time. If I got a unique time, and that average can be given by the ground state distribution and the average of the quantity I'm interested in. Okay. Now we talk quantum mechanics. That was all classical, pretty much. Here's again the model. Go to the Hamiltonian, classical Hamiltonian on a lattice. If we were to quantize that for the free theory, set G0 equal to 0, we would have an e to the minus phi squared type term. There's no coupling between different spatial sites. Do the Fourier transform of that, and then take the continuum limit. That becomes this expression. If I'm now interested in the coupled theory, with the nonlinear theory, then it too will be a product over different wave functions because there's no coupling, but some function, a W up here, which is replacing the phi squared because we've got the phi to the fourth. Again, the Fourier transform of that and the continuum limit, and now comes the central limit theorem. Central limit theorem says you've got to get a Gaussian out of that with some perhaps different mass. So that's the triviality of this model. This model is clearly also non-renormalizable because every closed loop, look at picture number 2 here, every closed loop will diverge because the propagator has 1 over p0 squared plus m squared. It does not have p vector squared, the spatial parts. So that's a non-renormalizable theory, and it has triviality, which we're used to. Let's take a moment. Let's look at some moments. And here I have simple Gaussian. It's motivated by this problem. And I have this question here. And I want to evaluate that. I expand that summation out. I will say that there is something called n prime, number of points in my lattice. And there are p of those. So I have terms in the sum, there are n prime to the power p, and each of the remaining monomials integrates, let's say, to order 1. So I get a contribution from that integral of o to the n prime p. And if n prime goes to infinity, as it must in a continuum limit, then I get divergences. So we all blame the divergences on the fact that we have an infinite number of variables. I claim that's not the real point, the real culprit. At this point, there are several ways to solve the problem. I'm going to give you the most cleanest and quickest story. That story comes from changing coordinates. Let's look at coordinates over here in picture 4. In three dimensions, we typically go x1, x2, x3. Here's the radial coordinate. The r squared then is the sum of all these other guys with direction cosines, and the sum of those cosine squares is 1. I want to do that for all of the phi k's. I want the sum of the phi k's, that's my whole lattice family, going to be kappa squared. And the eta k's are the direction cosines, and they all add up to 1 squared. In those coordinates, this integral, which gave me this divergence, becomes kappa squared a cubed p, e to the minus kappa squared a cubed. And this is the Jacobian of the transformation from here to these new coordinates. There's no more sum now to take out to count the number of variables. So where does this divergence come from here? It comes from right here, n prime, kappa to the n prime minus 1. There are n prime terms in this sum, and just like r squared dr in three dimensions, this becomes kappa to the n prime minus 1. As n prime gets colossal, then we have to use a stationary phase approximation on this integral. And these two terms I'm circling right now tell me that kappa squared is of order n. If kappa squared is of order n prime, then n prime to the p, I get the same kind of answer. But there is also the clue how to avoid the divergence. Suppose I was able to change this n prime to another number r, kappa to the n prime minus 1, kappa to the r minus 1, which was finite throughout the calculation, did not go to infinity, then there would be no reason for steepest descent evaluations. This integral would be perfectly natural over kappa, and I would get finite answers. This is the cause of the problem, and this is the cure for the problem. I tell you what my r is going to be. N prime is part of that n prime. A cubed is the lattice volume. B is a constant with dimensions inverse length cubed, so this becomes a dimensionless number. Now, how can I do that? I certainly cannot change the Jacobian. Question.
What is n prime?
What? N prime,
yeah,
is the total number of lattice points in my spatial slice. That's the number of terms in this sum.
And what is B?
B is a pure constant brought in to change the dimensions of the length cube so that this is a dimensionless number. That's all. Could be 1. Okay. So, as I say, I cannot make this change in the Jacobian. That's sacred. But I can make it in my ground state. I can change what I call the ground state from the free theory to the pseudo-free theory. And in that ground state, I will have an extra term which takes this guy into that guy. Okay, so here it is. This is the product in the lattice of the individual ground states that make up the total ground state. I'm going to change that. I'm going to say that this becomes my pseudo-free ground state. Here it is. This is remnants from the R that you saw before. Put that into the distribution. Here is the free part. Here is the modification to make it a pseudo-free. Here's the Fourier transform. That's going to be my characteristic function for the ground state, pseudo-free ground state distribution. Two changes of variables, and I take the continuum limit, and I get this answer. B is there again to remove the dimensions. 1 minus cosine lambda, e to the minus b lambda squared d lambda over mod lambda. That's a Poisson distribution, not a Gaussian distribution. And in fact, the symmetry of this model, which says everything is independent, can only be realized by Gaussians or Poisson distributions. This is the way to end up with a Poisson distribution. Well, what about divergences? Let's look at our divergences. This is the calculation we had before when that was the only part of the distribution, but now we're adding this as our pseudo-free ground state distribution. We make our coordinate transformations to these new variables. Here is the Jacobian contribution, the evil that caused the divergences before, but here is the kappa contribution from this guy. And you can see that the n primes are going to cancel, and I get my r minus 1 here. So there are no divergences. This is a product of something called affine quantization. It overcomes triviality, and it overcomes non-renormalizability.
John?
Yes, sir.
Can I try to put in simple terms what you've said? Because without all the details, what you've done is what you've done something like the following. You said, everywhere in perturbation theory, you have a free wave function. I'm going to replace it by a very singular wave function that looks roughly like the Gaussian divided by the field. Because if I take the phi to the minus 1 minus 2 a cubed, but a cubed is going to 0.
Why don't you sit up closer so I can understand you better?
That's okay. I'll talk more loudly.
Please.
You're roughly speaking, dividing the Gaussian wave function by phi.
Yes.
By absolute value of phi. So you're changing the wave function to be a highly singular, highly divergent object.
At the origin, it's an integrable singularity.
And the claim is that this removes the wave function renormalization of free field theory.
That was the last, you have to help me translate. What was the last?
It removes the wave function renormalization of the free field theory.
It removes all renormalizations. Everything is finite. As long as you make a perturbation about this ground state, not the other ground state, not the real ground state. This is my pseudo-free. The pseudo-free, I'm telling you, has a finite term-by-term perturbation theory about that point, not about that point. OK, I'm ready to move on to gravity, if you guys are. OK. So. Yes.
So this, what you had with the free theory, right?
Say again?
You were talking about the free theory.
Well, I was talking about the pseudo-free theory.
Right, no, but I mean the Lagrangian, there wasn't any...
Okay, fine. Oh, hell, that's not the one I want. Suppose I have an interaction in this theory. Then this term gets changed. We had it called a W in a previous part. This gets more complicated. That would simply complicate this part of the story. That's all it does. It changed that lambda squared to something else up there. I can even suppose it was lambda 4. Then I could make a power series expansion in that lambda 4, and everything would be finite.
So can you think of this as a sort of UV cutoff?
There's no UV cutoff. It's taken, the limit has been taken. You are going around the wrong free theory in past life.
Okay.
Yes, sure, loud.
In other words, is this a change of representation?
Change of representation?
Yeah.
Of the field operator?
Yeah.
Sure.
You are changing the measure.
Well, I had a Gaussian distribution of the field before. Now I have a Poisson distribution, clearly inequivalent.
Yeah.
OK. Now, ADM says these are the canonical variables. By the way, everything from now on with a red underline is bad. So I'm going to insist that this spatial metric satisfy this condition for any x, provided all the u's do not literally vanish. It has to be strictly positive, not greater than or equal to 0, I don't want equal to zero because I want to be able to invert that matrix. So I want it to be strictly greater than zero. Let's look at the compatibility of this momentum with that guy. Take this quantity pi percent, which is integrated against the test function here. Here's the dynamical variable. And make a global canonical transformation by this. So I expand that out in a power series. And it terminates quickly and gives me G plus U. So if G was a positive definite matrix before satisfying that, that could be violated completely. If U is sufficiently negative, it won't work. It's not consistent with positivity. That's bad news. Instead, we're just going to lower an index. Lower that C, and we get pi AB of X. Green, green. These two guys are red. Again, I have my metric positivity condition. And I now take a different smearing of the upstairs, downstairs pi. Make that by canonical transformation generator. Get the power series, and lo and behold, I get this expression, where M is a 3x3 matrix, which is made from E to the gamma by 2. Gamma was this matrix up here. And you can see that if this was positive definite before, it's going to be positive definite again. So it is this variable and this variable, 6 of the G's, 9 of the N's. I'm not saying they're dual variables. Get it out of your head. They are the proper kinematical variables to preserve the symmetry. Space-like surfaces, my light cones, so everybody is space-like as we go along. I'm going to use one of these space-like surfaces to define things, but I'm going to argue that it's the same whether it's here or here or here, that I can shove this up here smoothly to lie on top of that. That's an equivalent space-like surface. So everything I say could be on any space-like surface. Okay, so we've agreed classically that these are the good guys to keep. Let's promote them to operators and take the Poisson brackets between those coordinates in the classical domain and use those in the quantum commutators. So this set of three equations was originally the Poisson brackets, but now it turned into commutators and putting an I in and things like that. Pi with pi gives me a pi. G with pi gives me a G. And two G's gives me zero. My God, that's the number one. That should be the end of that bracket. Sorry about that. This is a Lie algebra. We didn't have that before with the canonical story, Q and G and pi by itself. More than that, this set of equations looks like the current commutation relations. And as current commutation relations, they have incredibly different, vastly different operator representations than the representations of the canonical bracket variables. Let's see how this story works out, preserving metric positivity here. Let's take the operator pi as a test function smearing out the operator here. This is going to be self-adjoint because these will be unitary, as we see. There's a unitary transformation on my operator G hat. Again, I expand that out. And that comes to exactly the same formula we had before, M related to gamma this way. And if this operator was positive definite before in the quantum theory, it will be positive definite again. Those are the variables to be used. Okay. Given pi, which we just had on the previous transparency, it's a smeared form of pi operator hat up and down, and little g star as a smeared form with g hat. Now, pi here is this C number tensor density. This is a simple tensor by itself. I put those two generators, self-adjoint generators, up into the exponent to make unitary transformations on a fixed vector eta which I call the fiducial vector, and that's going to give me the coherent states appropriate to this problem. Now you can see a G here, which you didn't see a G on this side, you only saw a gamma and a pi. I'm about to explain why that G is there. The expectation value of eta of the operator G hat AB cannot be zero. That's a positive definite operator. So we'll call it G tilde of AB. And the expectation value of pi hat can be zero, and we'll choose it to be zero. So there is a metric G hat, which is coming out of eta, which we will serve to define the topology of our problem on the space-like surface. Like there's a, it's isomorphic or squeezable down to a flat space or to a Schwarzschild space or something else. Those would be built into this, but otherwise, any details of that we don't know. We're choosing eta as an extremal weight vector, just as we do for the traditional canonical coherent states. And when put together with that and the choice of eta, this becomes the coherent state overlap function in its full glory, B of X. B is the similar B that we had before to change dimensions. But now it becomes a scalar density in this formulation. We have the tensor G upstairs. We have the tensor pi upstairs. This is a tensor. This is a tensor density. But I'm dividing by BX dividing. Therefore, it takes its density part away. So both of these are proper things. And this provides normalization to the story. So G, which enters this answer, comes from G tilde by our friends the M's, which we've seen several times before now there. So everything is in terms of G and pi. Looks canonical, I will grant you. But it didn't come that way. Okay. So here it is one more time. These two determinants in the bottom provide normalization. And being inside a logarithm, they come out separately. It's log of the numerator minus log of the denominator, for example. So those guys are just normalizations. The heart of the problem, if you will, is in the numerator here. And you'll notice that G double prime comes together with pi double prime with an I and a B inverse. That's a complexification. And G prime comes together with pi prime with a minus sign, minus IB inverse. So that's the complex conjugate of that. So we have an analytic underground going on. Notice also that if I make a coordinate transformation over the whole space, G going to G tilde, pi going to pi tilde, beta, B going to B tilde when X goes, then I get a invariance under coordinate transformations of that expression, and that will be useful later. Where did this come from? Let me review that for you, and we're going to see the mashing measure. Measure mashing, I don't know if I use that word for the scalar theory, but that measure mashing was taking that evil kappa to the n prime and making it kappa to the r. Okay, so let's look at this guy.
Question?
Yeah, question.
Your functional G and pi, G prime, pi prime, et cetera, are they smooth or finite?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. Because these are coherent state test functions. They are not anybody's eigenfunctions.
If you go back, can you go back one slide?
Yep.
Okay, so the claim is that there exists a state eta.
Wait, one more time.
There exists a state eta.
Yes.
Defined by the top line in green?
Well, defined by the extremal weight vector. So in fact, you'll see a little bit better what eta looks like on the
phone. It's an extremal weight vector of what algebra?
The Lie algebra of the brackets, which was pi upstairs, downstairs, and G.
And what determines the G tilde?
What determines the
G tilde?
Eta. It's part of eta. G just like when you do a canonical coherent state story, you have a Gaussian and you have a parameter, omega, depending on which, the width of that Gaussian. But if you're doing many of those Gaussians, that omega could change in location. So that could be omega of x.
So G twiddle labels the Hilbert space. Given a different choice of G twiddle, is a different Hilbert space?
We're gonna find out about that. That's not true. They're the same Hilbert space. That's the miracle. Okay. Yes, I would have thought that to begin with. Okay, here we go. So let's look at how this was constructed. Let's take our continuum on our space-like surface and break it up into little sites, just as we did in our field theory problem. So sub n labels a site, k, a bad notation, but there it is, labels the six coordinates, a, b, the six values of g at that particular site n. Kappa n stands for the matrix, which we want to be a positive definite matrix like we wanted for the g. And dk, case of n, is a product over those six variables that make up the components at each site. Now here is the site discrete form of this expression. Some constants, e to the minus cell volume, difference of pi's, summation of the g's, with a determinant kn. This looks like your 1 over phi that you were focusing on in the scalar theory. Down here, an integration on the dkn's. Let us pretend to go to the hyperspherical variables again. Kappa squared is the sum of all possible integrations, the six of them at every site squared, plus the sum over every site, and the direction cosines left over. But of course, the evil one is the kappa one. So let's see what happens to the kappa one. DKN carries six kappas by itself, because there are six fellows in that product. And we're going to say that there are capital N with a sum, with absolute N, six N total number of variables, six in each site and N sites. And N minus one, D kappa. That's what happens from the Jacobian, from the transformation of these variables. But look at this guy, the determinant himself. Determinant is 3 by 3, so he comes out with kappa cubed times 2 is minus 6. The product over every point is exactly enough to cancel that 6n. And what's left over at the end of the story is a kappa raised to a 6, b sub n, b can change over space, lattice site minus 1. Or the r value, which we saw was the finite quantity we were interested in before, in this case, 6 summation n bn delta. Sum n times delta is like the volume of the space. We're staying with a finite volume that's finite. And therefore, all moments within this integral turn out to be finite, independent of the nature of b, for example. OK, so that's why I was emphasizing your different Hilbert spaces. Not working. Okay. So what do we got? We've got the coherent state overlap. What good is that? I would like a functional representation of my Hilbert space, and by golly, I want an integral definition of my inner product. But don't worry, you don't need that. If you don't know about reproducing kernel Hilbert spaces, you should, and here it is. Take a topological space L, points in L, and being topological has the notion of continuity. And if it was a capital L dimensional, there would be simple coordinates to describe that point. Introduce a continuous function of positive type, kappa, k rather, depending on two points, L prime and L, in this space. And I make it continuous, so these functions are continuous. And I now define the positive type story. I take a complex set of numbers, alpha sub j, alpha I complex conjugate. Some of these, both up to capital J, should be non-negative. The Gelfand-Neimark-Siegel theorem then tells us there exists an abstract Hilbert space, vectors in that Hilbert space. So it's this overlap function, this continuous function of positive type, is nothing but the inner product of two vectors from that abstract Hilbert space. Okay, great. How can I make a functional representation of that Hilbert space? Here's an abstract vector given by sum of the L's, another one given the sum by the L. Just like we do in Dirac notation, we take a basis, X's or P's or something, and take the inner product with those. But I don't have an X or a P hanging around. All I know is the states L. So I'm going to take the inner product with little L vectors and little L vectors here, and that will define my functional representation for these two guys. And then I want to know what the inner product will be. Well, I just take this equation and take the inner product by itself, psi with phi. I get that quantity, and I will define that as the inner product of my two functions. Every function in this Hilbert space is continuous functional. I complete it. I've done everything with finite indices here, but now I complete it by limiting Cauchy sequencing. Everything about the space, the functional representation and the inner product, comes from the reproducing kernel. And we're going to make this coherent state function our reproducing kernel. So it will define the Hilbert space. OK. Here is the overlap function one more time. We saw before that there were normalization factors, and then we had kind of an analytic form for the argument. These normalization factors, I can really discard. I'm going to discard them by saying that the normalizations that might appear here, I can absorb into the alphas and the betas. These coefficients can pretend to do the work for me for the normalizations. Right. So now I only have this analytic story behind. And then I say, well, I can even go further. I don't need the pi's. I can set the two pi's equal to zero and give myself a set of overlap between two g's. That doesn't reduce the information I can get from this space, because these guys, I can always go back to the pi just by analytic continuation of to two g's. It covers that. Okay, now this g in a bra and a ked is not the eigenvector of a sharp operator g. In fact, the operator g expectation value in the coherent states as previously defined is the C number g. And the expectation value in the coherent states of the up-down pi is pi AB, which is this guy, lowered by GBC, which comes from here, to give me a pi AC. So it is expectation values of the operators which are coming from these. Now, so far I haven't introduced any constraints, because that's what Dirac tells us. Quantize first, reduce second. I'm now going to give you a kind of sleight of hand, all right, overview of the constraint story. There's a method called a projection operator method, which uses a projection operator here, E, with these properties. We're going to let it be regulated so it keeps in the same Hilbert space. And that E acting on the kinematical Hilbert space will give me a regulated form of my physical Hilbert space. So I can imagine taking matrix elements in the states we have isolated here of this vector, of this projection operator E. Or even simpler, I can drop the pi's as we did here, because they can always be recovered. So I'm going to focus on this kind of quantity. Question?
Yes. Sometimes when you project out by a constraint, you get the solutions that what's left after you project out is not normalizable in the inner product.
Somebody else help me. What's he saying?
So sometimes when you project out, some solutions that you get are not normalizable.
E?
Yeah, well.
The kernel of E may consist of states which are not normalizable in the inner product response.
Can we hold that question to the end? And I'll tell
sure.
you my technique of doing things like that. OK, so at the moment, let's to treat them as true. I avoid your question at the moment by saying if it's in the continuum, the zero in the continuum, I do not project on that point. I project to a small window, zero to delta. And therefore, I am have still in this original space. Going to delta to zero is the second step. OK. OK. So this should be familiar to you, how we do constraints. Take a vector z, which is in an n-dimensional real vector space, n bigger than or equal to 2, and define this as a reproducing kernel given by that function. This reproducing kernel has an invariance. If I rotate z double prime and I rotate z prime at the same time, O being an element of the n-dimensional orthogonal group over the reals, then this quantity becomes this quantity equals that. So I have an invariance under that rotation. Liken that in your mind to what I said before about the coherent state overlap function being totally invariant if I transform all the pi's, all the g's, all the b coordinate-wise, then it's invariant. So now I want to go to add constraints to this problem. I want to say that every generator of the rotation group that sits here, that generator is forced to be zero. So the whole vector of such thing should be zero. That means I should have literally separate invariants for each vector. That's what the projection operator should tell me. This is the projection operator, but it doesn't matter. I should have the orthogonal on this side, or either side. That means that this overlap with this projection, saying that all these generators vanish, could look like this. We had this one before, but now we have separate invariants of the bra and the kit. OK, let's realize it. Here it is. This is an orthogonal group. So here's a representation of this acting there. I'm going to integrate over the group. It's a finite group. Life is simple for ourselves. Imagine you're in three dimensions, which you know about. Then this dot product is nothing but the length of those two vectors times the cosine of the angle between them. And you would integrate that in three dimensions. That would be sine theta d theta. The d phi parts you don't care about, nothing in there. But extend that to n dimensions, and that's the only change. OK, so that's some function. I don't want to know what it is. This integral runs from 0 to pi. And as I expand this out of the exponent, there will be terms where cosine theta is even power or odd power. The odd powers will disappear because integration between 0 and pi. And I only get the even powers left over. OK, so that's some integral that's going to do that. Now, that's the quantity I was trying to calculate. I'm going to argue it's too complicated to calculate. And I'm going to write something which has the right symmetry. This has the symmetry. It has the length squared, which comes in every even power of this vector, and the length squared of that vector. What is different will be the coefficients in this power series expansion with the coefficients in that power series expansion. But then I draw you picture 3 here. This is a vector. This is a matrix. This is a transpose vector. Suppose I put in S to the minus 1, S transpose to the minus 1, S transpose, and then call that combination V transpose S, this combination US, and this one the matrix. This is a similarity transformation. Nature does not care about the mathematics of us, whether we put the top line or the second line, we can interchange them at the same answer. It has to be true. That's why expectation values are the thing of importance. OK, so I'm going to try to find similarity transformations. So I claim that this guy is a similarity transformation of the one I had. But this is easier to work with. Also, I'm going to talk about toy models. I don't want to deal with every one of these terms. I just want to take the first L of those terms. And I can choose positive coefficients here, and I have a reproducing kernel for an L-dimensional Hilbert space, which has the same property of symmetry that these guys do. And here's another one. Take this guy up here and just raise every guy to the seventh power, so it just leaves a lot of people out, etc. Okay, those are the toy ones. Yeah. Okay, here's the diffeomorphism constraint story. Here's the fact that this is equal to itself under a coordinate transformation of both sides of the variable, including B. And indeed, pi by B is a tensor, and just as much as G is a tensor. If I want to put diffeomorphism invariant, however, on this guy with my projection operator, I need it to have invariance with either side, not in total alone. Or if I drop the pi's, then I should have this functional relationship. This should be independent of coordinate transformations over here or here or both. Now, I can't find all of those for you, but I can find examples. These are toy examples. This is a five-dimensional Hilbert space, not big, but this integral is an invariant under coordinate transformations there and there. Here's another version of a similar thing, and here's an infinite dimensional Hilbert space that I would expand out, and the terms would be separately invariant on left and right. I do that again and again. Okay, we're going to turn to functional integration. I talked about affine quantization at one point. These are single degree of freedom. This is an affine bracket, if you will, affine commutation relation between Q and D. D is not translation like P is, but D is dilation operator. Suppose we live in a world, this example where Q is positive. That's the analog of my metric positivity story. I have coherent states for these guys with some beta property. And the overlap of those coherent states is given by this function. If you look carefully, it'll look very much like what we had before for our coherent state overlap. We had a normalization part in our logarithm, and we had Q plus or minus I P prime divided by beta as our argument. Now, most functional integrals are postulated. I hear in the recent lecture about the measure on the G mu news in the gravitational story. So that's an unresolved problem, presumably. But this path integral representation derives completely from its analyticity properties. This is not a postulated expression. This is a derived quantity. It's a functional integral with a normalization, e to the minus iq p dot dp dq. If it wasn't for this term here, that would look kind of like a regular phase space path integral with vanishing Hamiltonian, as it should, vanishing Hamiltonian, because there's no dynamics in this story. Indeed, it looks very canonical at this point. But this coming exactly out of this analyticity property is a continuous time regularization. It involves a p dot squared and a q dot squared. That makes it like a Brownian motion. It has a q squared and a q inverse squared. That makes this measure not Cartesian, but actually it's the kind of measure on a Poincaré half plane. And the limit as nu goes to infinity at the end formally takes this away. And nevertheless, it comes out with this coherent state overlap function. Okay, that's the elementary story. Here is the beginning of the functional integral story. Here is our coherent state for the gravity story. And that has an expression very much like what we had just seen. here is the product over the momenta and the metric terms. There is this continuous time regularization factor here, which really builds a well-defined measure without this term here by itself. And here is the analog of our QP dot we had before, the first part of the Lagrangian for gravity. In fact, when you think about it, and you write down G dot here with indices, pi dot with indices, and then you say, I want to make something invariant out of that. That means I have to use something else with indices to saturate that. I can't use a pi because a pi can go through zero. I use the G's instead, which saturate these variables, the G's which saturate these. B in this formula has a dimension of an h bar. This, so does 2 pi, so I cancel one of those. And this is the quantity which we've seen before play the role of the dimensional change. So it's almost as if this particular form of the measure is put on top of us. If I include now the constraint, I beg your pardon, the diffeomorphism constraints, perhaps with an h bar, we have to work that out, and the Lagrange multiplier, and I now include that. This is not a Fadeyev-Popov story. Fadeyev-Popov enforces the classical constraints. This is a different kind of measure on those variables which enforce the quantum constraints. Okay, that gives me the E fellow we wanted for the diffeomorphisms between that. And we can go one more step. Include the Laplace function, N, as another Lagrange multiplier for the Hamiltonian, again, perhaps with h-bar contributions. We'll call that E star. That enforces all four constraints in this kind of integral. Okay. So we've introduced E, diffeomorphism constraint projector, and E star, all constraints. It would seem logical that this guy is within here because I've insisted on something else being constrained. The toy guys always were part of the diffeomorphism constraints that we had before. And so it is conceivable that E containing E star containing ET, that would mean that these toy examples would fulfill all of the constraints. Now, I argued before that the diffeomorphism constraints should hold on any space-like surface. This has been arranged to sit on any of those beautiful surfaces we talked about before. Now I borrow an argument from Karol Kuklach, which says that if I know the three diffeomorphism constraints on arbitrary space-like surfaces, then I know this underlined equation here, N being a time-like vector, sigma being a space-like vector, but those two vectors being orthogonal to each other. If I want to remove that orthogonality, I put in a Lagrange multiplier with a G. That Lagrange multiplier enforces G and this product of these two to be zero. But now I can free up those variables thanks to the Lagrange multiplier. Since I have arbitrary time-like vectors, I can take the difference of those and get a space-like. Arbitrary space-like, I can take the difference of those and get a time-like. So I get any vectors I want up here times this combination. So I can remove those guys. And that means I have the Einstein tensor equal to this, but we have a contracted Bianchi equation, sum on alpha here, which is automatically zero. That tells me this should be zero. And that forces lambda to be independent of position as a cosmological constant would be. So these are equations which determine the Lagrange multiplier. So those are second class constraints. The Hamiltonian constraint with cosmological constant is then is valid on any space-like surface. If it was going to be asymptotically flat out to infinity, then the G's would get weaker and weaker, and then lambda could be zero. So I'm proposing that the toy examples already indicated that satisfying the diffeomorphism constraints already would satisfy the Hamiltonian constraint, perhaps with a cosmological constant. Now, I know you're all anxious loop quantum gravity people who love to live with finite area and volume and things. So here's a speculation of how that might actually happen here. Let's take a toy projection operator from these vectors, call that combination that, and I define what I want it to be. Here it is, quantity on the line, and the same thing is up in the exponent. This has the feature that there is an operator A acting on these vectors for which these are eigenvectors, just like this. This is very much like traditional annihilation operators acting on standard coherent states. And so if I take A dagger A on this and divide by it, I simply get this. But what are the what is the spectrum of this operator? It's 0, 1, 2, 3. Let's look at the 0 case. The 0 case would mean G equal to 0, but then my whole expression vanishes. So I could argue that we shouldn't include 0, and therefore I get a discrete counting of the volume. That's a speculation. I'm not going to defend it at all. What?
Is this a 1D model or a 3D?
1D? Yeah. Heavens, no.
Is that DX really a D3X?
What did you say?
Is that the one-dimensional model or a three-dimensional model? That's what. Three-dimensional?
Oh, you're right. I should have put three. You're right. You're absolutely
just
right.
To clarify,
thank you. Good point. Yeah, so I didn't put derivatives here. We could have derivatives. If we live in a finite space, compact space, then we could actually add just those terms as I've done toward the end here. Yep, I forgot the three.
Oh, no.
Right. Okay, summary time for summary. Affine variables preserve the strict metric positivity. My mother asked me to ask you if your variables do the same. Affine coherent state overlap function is divergence free thanks to measure meshing. That's our capital R trading the N prime for a capital R. The reproducing kernels are very useful. They may have representations via path integrals, as we saw. And toy diffeomorphism invariant reproducing kernels satisfy, or perhaps may satisfy, all of the constraints. Thank you very much. Well, I've only worked it out for this scalar field. I'm working hard on spinners as well.
So I'm just wondering basically what it means, because we do have non-normalizable theories in Rentscher, which means that there are effective field theories, and there are good description below the cutoff, but as they approach the cutoff, you need a different theory.
That's the philosophy.
So, but I mean, it seems that what you're saying is that you don't have to do that.
That's right. That's right. You can, if you want to solve it, you can solve it. It can be solved using this great principle that the free theory is irrelevant.
But like, for example, to like a big Fermi
yes.
4-point attraction, I mean, that's the famous example of it's a non-normalizable theory. And the way you make it renormalizable is by adding gauge bosons. Like,
well, nature chose that choice.
Yeah, but I mean, if it was up to you,
I can do your four Fermis without the spatial gradients. Like I did this first model with only the time gradient, I can do a time fermion derivative plus four Fermi interaction. I've done that.
But we do have gradients, so.
I would like to introduce the gradients, so I'm going to try to introduce them. Yeah.
But you would get, so you're just saying that this is an option that sometimes nature does take and other times nature may not.
Right. To say everything is effective and high energy string theory will take care of it is a cop out, in my opinion. Cop out? It's a.
Yeah.
You understand?
No, I understand. I'm just saying. Yeah, but sometimes you don't expect too much. I mean,
there is a certain level of limit to human intelligence that you may not guess everything based on low energies. And
I won't even touch that question. Yeah, Tim.
In the construction of coherent states that you described, if you think of a gravitational field or the three metric as resolved amongst those coherent states, then although the coherent states is an overcomplete basis,
yeah,
the resolution of the given geometry amongst the coherent states is a unique one. The coherent states have this special property of uniqueness.
Oh, in what sense of unique?
Well, the decomposition of the given vector amongst the coherent states is a unique decomposition, despite the overcompleteness of the coherent state basis.
Well, by definition, if they're overcomplete, it can't be unique.
Well, the coherent states have a special property that it is unique. So if you...
Well, the diagonal matrix element of an operator uniquely determines the operator. And if I say that the overlap of a vector with the coherent states is zero for all arguments, then that vector is zero. But that does not mean that the vector has a unique representation in an overcomplete family.
Amongst your canonical coherent states.
Right, right. Yeah.
The paper you gave me to read, which was also about this, but wasn't covered in your talk.
One more time.
Okay. The paper you gave me to read, which wasn't covered in this talk, but is also part of the subject of affine.
Yes.
Suggested certain parallels between affine quantum cosmology and the kind of results that one has in loop quantum cosmology.
Okay.
Could you tell us a bit about that?
That's not my specialty, unfortunately. I leave that to others, so I really can't. I honestly don't know about it. I don't cite myself in that issue. This young lady considers working in that direction. I don't know how that's going to go.
I am analyzing. There
is a reference in there, in that paper, to a recently posted archive paper in which people did look at the FRW.
They just consider Friedman-Roshan worker with no cosmological constant, but in vacuum. And yeah, they claim that the scale factor doesn't go to zero. Like, they derive the 50 dynamics coming from a fine quantization
Cosmologies worked in Robertson Walker quantum cosmologies whose quantization was consistent with it coming from an affine procedure. So the issue then is why, if Robertson Walker has been done already for some affine work, it was why those didn't see any sort of singularity resolution or anything like that, whereas it's been seen now. But although maybe what you say about them being in vacuum could explain that, because these were typically calculations done by Eichen in the 70s or following from that. And in those, there was a scalar field. And in those, I think nothing special or singularity resolution occurs.
Yeah, because the amount of water in vacuum, they did not dynamic, because they constrain freezes the dynamics.
Yeah, through that as well.
Yeah.
In relation to this, I really need that.
Thank you.